that I've done an offering at Spirit Rock on the Dharma and poetry. And each of these years there's been a theme, and the theme this year was the dance of joy, sorrow, and grief. And I don't know how many people from the Sangha were here. Maybe let's see, show of hands. Quite a few. So you can hear about it from them. They can tell you their favorite poem. But I'm going to read you a couple of the poems tonight at one point from the day long, and then read one thing that was not in the day long that I had with me, but I didn't get to it. But I'm going to I start with a slightly different place that having to do with sort of indirectly with the theme, and then hopefully at the end have just time for questions about anything that you want to ask questions about. And so where I want to start is with this, the understanding of emptiness. That is a key part of the Buddhist progress of insight, where at one point one realizes that phenomena is empty of lasting essence. So everything that is put together is empty of permanent form, because anything that's put together goes back apart. Everything, our bodies, our minds, the lectern here, the chair you're sitting on, the earth that we're all resting on, the cosmos itself. If everything that has been created is of the nature to cease to be, because that is the very process. As the Venerable Sumedho would say, being born is a death sentence. And that's true whether it's a universe, a galaxy, a moment, an hour, a day, a puppy dog. It is just the nature of this realm. And that the ultimate emptiness on that level, we can think of in terms of the Nietzsche, that everything changes. We can also think of it in terms of that the mind moments, that the objects that are being known, so you're knowing right now the hearing, or you're noticing seeing, or knowing the temperature in the room, the temperature on your body, that too is empty of permanence, that it has no ultimate form. It's gone. It's gone. This moment's gone. That moment's gone. Things come and go. This at first can seem very frightening, very dispiriting, but when experienced in a mature way, it turns out that it is a very liberating experience. It is not a negative experience. It's freeing. Freeing what? Freeing the grasping mind. The ridiculousness of grasping onto something that going away, this doesn't make any sense. It's not like, oh, it's not a thought out process. It's just that it's a direct realization of, oh, I've been relating to this wrong. That is the way it is. It's just not the way it is. Because the mind is so quick and all this, there's reasons that this is a very difficult realization to occur. I'm not introducing this tonight in terms of trying to present an explanation for you of it, in terms of the realization, but rather to talk about something that I call premature emptiness. And the reason I'm talking about it tonight is because it does, I would have, if we had more time yesterday in the day long, I would have talked about this, because one form that premature emptiness takes is the form that comes from having a great loss or any other kind of great trauma. So this is a very sensitive subject, and we want to listen with great respect and all this in terms of this and just the feeling of this. This, because I'm going to talk through five types of this premature emptiness that I've witnessed in people. But I'm starting with the one that's the most delicate, the most sensitive, and the most understandable. And that is this emptiness of when you lose someone that you love, or that you have a a big trauma that happened to you, and it tore out your trust in the world. So you no longer trust the world, and it all seems empty of meaning because it's not safe in any way. Or that I remember working with this woman, she'd be quite comfortable with my saying this about our experience together, who attended retreats at Cloud Mountain for a number of years, whose two children, young children, had died in that Alaska airplane crash. They had been on vacation with their dad, from whom she was divorced. The plane went down, and he and these two children died, and along with the other people in that. And she, for years, till she started working in meditation, had this was her. She'd wake up in the morning, and there was just no meaning. There was an emptiness to everything. So everything just felt empty. There was no zest. There was no life. There was no purpose. She just kind of lived her life for a long time. And gradually through meditation, she found her way back to a real relatedness to life itself. The moment of life did not seem empty. Because this is in the premature emptiness, what happens is that we can start to feel that life has no meaning, because the way it's confused of two levels, the relative level and the absolute level, in a way that is very hard to get out of once you get in it. And some of you may have experienced this. Some of you might be experiencing it now. You may have loved ones that have gone through this. So really, there's nothing wrong with the person. It's just a difficult situation. This kind of feeling of premature emptiness. What's it when a line touches another line in one point? I don't know what too many people say, and I can't hear. But you know what I mean? Like if the line comes down here and touches in one point, and then it goes back out.
Tangent.
I don't think so, but tangent. Whatever the word is. Anyway, this kind of feeling of emptiness actually is getting the message, but getting it in the wrong way and at the wrong level. So the feeling of that emptiness is part of the realization of something that happens in our practice, but it's getting it at the wrong level, and it's something that has to be worked through. But with that knowledge, then can stay. So there's some piece of real valuable knowledge there, but it's not been integrated at the right level of insight. But the knowledge is real in my experience of this. So that's this one level of premature emptiness. And for whatever reason, as a retreat teacher, I often find myself working with people who, through a loss of some kind, or through some untoward event that's happened to them, has this feeling. And it's one has to go slow with this, and again, be very respectful. Moving away from that, the second kind of premature emptiness that I have encountered is where someone's had a big intellectual understanding. And it may not even been through Buddhism, but through one form or another, there's this intellectual understanding. They had a really good intellectual grasp of something. Oh, this is what emptiness is. I know this now. I understand this. And they speak with others. They take stances in relation to this and so forth. And sometimes are actually very good at describing emptiness. But there's no direct insight. It's all up in the coconut. And is not in the end empowering to the person. Insofar as that one has that kind of experience and you keep practicing, then it will lead to this inside level of the emptiness, this direct experience, this kind of awakened feeling of, oh, it's a very different thing than an intellectual understanding. So the intellectual understanding is not in itself a bad thing, although it can be used unskillfully, because thinking it's more than it is, as you will hear in a moment in a poem, that this is this can be a challenge, and it can be a challenge for others who come under the influence of someone who is in a way of being the teacher. It could be a professor in a university. It could be your best friend. It could be anyone who has some intellectual understanding of something but without any direct experience. And then you're hearing all of this, and what does this mean? And what you're hearing without the preparation, not so skillful a thing. So if one encounters that, one wants to go, maybe this isn't where I want to have this conversation. And one guards oneself a bit from an intellectualization of the teaching of emptiness. A third way that this will show up is around someone who has had a, and I don't have the words, I'm not a psychotherapist, so I don't have these words the way someone else might use it, but in my lay terms as a Dharma teacher, there where they've had an ego collapse such that everything feels empty because their ego has no vitality anymore. There could be a physiological part of that where there's been a some sort of disease that or some sort of a virus or something that's really sapped all of the energy, and so that there's a the ego itself has gotten defeated in a kind of emotional way, but also there's been this kind of just this combination of these two. It's hard to talk about this subject, and so the person will report language that can sound like a kind of spiritual realization, but it is the ego saying, I can't find any meaning right now. I can't find a way of organizing. It is not this deeper understanding reporting its experience. It's the ego. Again, to be treated with great kindness and compassion, but not to, if that's happening to us, not to buy into that, just to thinking that that was a spiritual insight. And this can happen at any age, by the way. Young people, people in your 20s or 30s, subject to it one way, subject to it a different way in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. So this kind of psychological emptiness can occur. Another kind of emptiness, premature emptiness that I have witnessed is what I would call nihilism, which the Buddha so cautioned against. When you see that everything's changing, well, then nothing matters. And there's a kind of, that there's nothing that's substantial. It can come up in a non-Buddhist way, so it did not come up part of a spiritual teaching. And all it came up because in your life, you had this kind of thing, that kind of thing happen, and you developed this kind of bitter or non-believing or resentment of life, resentment of the world, resentment of your world, and there's a kind of emptiness to it, that this feeling, and so one then encounters some spiritual tradition where this is part of, and then one says, yes, I know that. But really what you know is that you're having to deal with a lot of nihilism in your life. Or again, a friend of yours or a family member may be going through this kind of situation, and again, coming about because of conditions. So there's no bad people here. It's not that kind of thing. It's seeing that this mind state of premature emptiness is not skillful, and being able to recognize it in ourselves or recognize it in others in a way that helps us know the appropriate response. And then the fifth kind of premature emptiness that I wanted to introduce in tonight is one that has almost a kind of a a character element. I'll use that word. The word I wrote down to say to you was intrinsic feeling of emptiness. That it's intrinsic. It feels not something that you figured out, not something that happened because of an event in your life, not because of your ego's experience, but that it's like it was some piece of the wiring in the brain's development. That there was some wiring that got a little off, and that there's this feeling of a kind of vacancy that where there's a certain developmental things that I would say still need to be done, and that the brain will still respond because we know the plasticity of the brain. We know that the brain. I'm just reading the book of that woman who had the stroke that everybody read years ago. I finally got it to that on my list. And her talking about her losing access to the left side of the brain and just having the right side of the brain. Someone that knows the name of the book.
My stroke of insight.
So this kind of emptiness... I can remember encountering it in a child, a school age, a school boy, still in the elementary school years, and insofar as I could, as much as the parents would give me access in a way, working with this and this child. The child had a kind of sophistication coming out of this, but the sophistication was not grounded. It wasn't real. It was lacking a heart quality, and it missed all the subtlety of the feeling. There was a kind of perception that wasn't wrong, but it wasn't contextualized. Do you see what I mean by that? Yes. And I've certainly seen this in people of all other ages, too. And so none of this is the Buddha's teaching on not self. None of it's the teaching of the Buddha's on anicca or dukkha. These are not realizations in that way. They're mind states, they're attitudes of mind that have come about due to various conditions, and the problems of them, if cultivated through practice, some of those things that they have as part of this experience can in fact be useful in a deeper understanding. But in and of themselves, they're not forward leading. And this is one of the things about the Dharma. What's considered skillful in the Dharma is that which is forward leading. It leads us on to a deeper understanding, a further realization, a greater awakening, a stronger release of attachment, of grasping, an ease in relation to the dukkha of life, to the difficulties of life, a kind of choice between being, instead of being reactive to situations, to being responsive to situations. So when you see this, and all of these things I just named, are how you know, is this some sort of real spiritual realization or not? If the mind, if it's a reactive mind, This isn't a spiritual realization. If there's not choice, it's just on and on. This isn't a spiritual realization. This is something else coming about because of other conditions. And that's true for us, or true for someone that we know and love and care for, or someone that's in some role that in this moment in time we're listening to as the teacher, as the instructor, as someone who knows more than us. And so in each of these instances, to go to this kind of, no, there's a different feeling to this than, this doesn't feel like a spiritual teaching. This feels like something else. It's detectable in your own feeling, the way your own body, your own heart, your own intuition will respond to this. So, in each of these instances, it's not necessarily up to us as individuals, to, if it's someone else, to think we're supposed to fix them. And this one of the places where fixing will often happen, and again, this is why I was wanting to do this yesterday, is people want to fix someone else's sorrow or someone else's grief, you know. And I work with people all the time, and I don't think I'm supposed to be fixing someone's sorrow. I mean, it doesn't seem like the appropriate response at all to me. One holds the possibility for someone. One meets sorrow in a certain way, but one doesn't try to fix it. And the same with grieving. Grief, it's not up to you to stop someone else's grief. It's not that way. And so sometimes that emptiness, as I said, was so associated with one or both of those feelings of sorrow and grief in that way. And but one treats it with respect in that way. Not an easy topic to be bringing up. And I will, like I say, hopefully we'll have time for some questions about this. This is a poem by Rumi. It's an excerpt that I chose. Those of you who know about the Poetry Day know that I collect poems all year, and then when I decide on a theme, I select the poems that fit that theme. And like this year, there was probably 150, maybe 140, maybe 160, that range of poems that I started with, getting down to the ones that I use. Takes a long time. And this is an excerpt from, it's too long, the whole poem to use. And he says, inside each of us, there's continual autumn. Inside each of us, there's continual autumn. Autumn, the falling away. Inside each of us, there's continual autumn. Our leaves fall and are blown out over the water. Void of time into the unconscious. Inside each of us, there's continual autumn. Our leaves fall and are blown out over the water. A crow sits in the blackened limbs and talks about what's gone. A crow sits in the blackened limbs and talks about what's gone. Then your generosity returns. Spring, moisture, intelligence, the scent of the hyacinth and rose and cypress. And if you don't feel in yourself the freshness, weep and then smile. Don't pretend to know something you haven't experienced. There's a necessary dying, and then there is breathing again. Very little grows on jagged rock. Be ground. Be crumbled so wildflowers will come up where you are. You've been stony for too many years. Try something different. Surrender. Beautiful, beautiful evocation of this feeling of turning towards life without denying the sorrow in life, without denying the grief in life, without denying the feelings of emptiness that we all experience momentarily, and that some of us have experienced for longer periods of time, and some of us may have had realizations of kind around. So this continual autumn, the continual autumn, and our leaves fall. The moments of our lives fall. Those we care for fall. This falling, this leaves, there's a this seasoning of a life, of each person's life, of stages of life, and so on. And they're blown out over the water. We can't hold on to them. We can't prevent this. It's natural in this way. And yes, and then there's mourning. There's the black crow, the shroud. There's this feeling of that. This is natural. It's natural around someone's death. It's natural around loss of other kinds in our lives. And all kinds. It's just a necessary part. But then there comes this spring. There's this rebound, this recovery. But not always. Not right now. There's not always the spring. And that's okay too. That's okay too. Not trying to force something, but rather the skillful means is being available to the spring. To recognize that the spring is there and to be available. Insofar as possible, I wish to be available to be part of the spring. And another way of saying it is wishing that we wished we were available. Maybe I wish I was available, but maybe that's too strong for us. So we wish that we wished that we were available. Do you feel that? And that, so it is. And Rumi says, if you don't feel in yourself the freshness, weep. That's okay. It's all natural. And then smile. And so that the smile is coming from the acknowledgement of the situation, but the smile is towards this invitation, this invitation of being. And then this line, and this is where I really wanted to get to in this, is don't pretend to know something you haven't experienced. Don't pretend to know something that you haven't experienced. He didn't say don't pretend to know something that you don't know. But don't pretend to know something you haven't experienced. So this knowing, the knowing of emptiness, there's a difference between the knowing of it as an intellectual concept, of it as a mind state that's been around for a while, versus this knowing of it as an experience and insight, in the context of insight. That's why I say in this first kind around sorrow, there is a touching of the insight level that, in my experience with a large number of people, is genuine, but it lacks the context, it lacks the support, it lacks the other factors of the Eightfold Path, if you like, whatever that may be, to make it this liberating understanding rather than a kind of depressing, debilitating, non-invigorating kind of understanding. So he then goes on, that there's necessary dying, and then there's breathing again. This rhythm of life, this rhythm, it contracts, it expands, opening to that. And even when we can't open to it, being available as though we could open to it, being available in this way. Very little grows on jagged rock. Be ground. Be crumbled. Be crumbled is to not hold on. To not hold on to our grief and to our sorrow. To let it break the heart, break it open. To let the solidity to thinking that things are supposed to be a certain way, let all that break up. Let it be the ground for some future growth, some future form of giving. The woman that I told you about that lost her children, her profession was already a helping profession. But she took it. She found her way back to life was being of service at yet another level. It was already, again, she read it was a helping profession, but she took it to yet another level of this, and that was how she made her way back. And slowly, joy came back into her life. And it's blossomed. It's blossomed. A woman on a retreat was so disturbing to people that the other teacher, disturbing to the teachers that were talking, that she was and practice groups with. It was so disturbing because she said, "Oh, I'm just sitting in emptiness. I'm just sitting in emptiness. Mm-hmm. Emptiness." And when they would try to say, "Well, how are you practicing?" There was a kind of dismissal of them. And there's this thing about this person really shouldn't be here because we don't know, are they really depressed? And we don't really know what what to do. And so maybe this is really not good for her, and the person's certainly not being very respectful, and so forth. And I said, this was fairly early on in my time teaching at retreats, and I said, well, would you mind if I got to have a session with her and see what my take on all this is? And in fact, it was one of these premature forms of emptiness around a great loss. Around a great loss. So not a death, but a great loss. That in that great loss, the seeing was correct, but it did not have the heart quality. It did not have it didn't have this context that frees. This person went on to have a really great practice and really deep, deep understanding. But again, we start where we are. And so in each of these instances, my job was to start where they were, not to say, oh, this is where you should be, and to say, oh, no, well, I'll fix you and get you there, but to attend to the experience at hand in that way. When we go through life, we're going through something together alone. So I talk on retreat about we're practicing together, but each person is practicing alone. We're practicing alone together. And at first that's a little confusing, but it actually turns out to be quite a beautiful experience. Here in Sangha, on this very night, we're practicing alone together. So I'll read you another poem. It's actually not a poem, but I lineated it. I made it single lines, but it was actually written originally as a paragraph from Wendell Berry, from his book, The Unforeseen Wilderness. Always in the wilderness, when you leave familiar ground and step off into a new place, there will be, along with the feeling of curiosity and excitement, a little nagging dread. It is the ancient fear of the unknown. And it is your first bond with the wilderness you're going into. What you are doing is exploring. You are undertaking the first experience, not of the place, but of yourself in that place. It is an experience of our essential loneliness. It is an experience of our essential loneliness. For nobody can discover the world for anybody else. It is only after we have discovered it for ourselves that it becomes a common ground and a common bond, and we cease to be alone. This is a tough message in a certain way, right? That we have to do this alone. But that essential loneliness is an existential fact. It is not a cause or a proof of emptiness. That's that kind of understanding, feeling, because we've all felt that existential angst of our aloneness. And also, he did not say, but of our alienation. Have you not felt alienated in your life? Even sometimes from your closest friends or your family, sometimes your partner, there you are with your significant other, and you feel totally alienated from that person. Just alienated. This is that essential loneliness in this way. It is an existential occurrence in the mind due to conditions. It is not a condition of the heart. The heart in its natural form does not have that kind of experience. It has the awakened heart. I'm using this in the Theravadan sense of heart, mind, this chitta. That it has a natural sense of connection. What in that book, The Stroke of Insight, she talks about the right side of the brain, that when she had no access to the left side of her brain, she felt total unity. there her brain was functioning, cognizing, but she felt total unity. She did not feel the separation. The separation has a function, a necessary function, but the value of practice and the insight that arises from practice is we drop at a deeper level than this functioning of the brain. And so that's why we have this sense of unity and all in the way that we have it when we as insight, as realization. So as we're going forth in our practice, we will hit loneliness. And as we're going forth in our daily life, we will hit our essential loneliness. And that is not to be taken as a sign of a permanent condition. It is in this moment's time, this is what's arising. Meet it with compassion, bring mindfulness to it, and continue on with the connection. I have to do it, you have to do it, you have to do it. Everyone here has to do this. Whether it's been recognized or not, these moments happen. And again, sometimes it can come about not from a personal reason, but the world can be so alienating when one reads and sees or witnesses the atrocities, the stupidity of what human beings do to one another, the callousness of our politician, their willingness to manipulate in these horrible ways. This can bring us into this sense of purposelessness, lack of meaning, lack of connectivity, this essential loneliness, this alienation, and kind of falling into the emptiness from that. So that too is part of it. From Rilke. Be patient towards all that is unsolved in your heart. Be patient towards all that is unsolved in your heart. And try to love the questions themselves like locked rooms and like books that are now written in a very foreign tongue. Do not seek the answers which cannot be given you because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. You've heard me say this in here other times. To live the questions. If I were going to say one of the characteristics of my life is that I actually, I some years ago, through defeat, learned to start doing this. Not through success, but through defeat. Because that's something that I actually could claim to myself, is that I could show up for the question. That I could genuinely show up for the question. It took me a long time to decide that I could genuinely show up for the question. It's not an automatic. You may think that you show up for the questions, but really look to see. Live the questions is the instructions. Do you live the question? That's not so easy to do, to live the questions. It makes us uneasy to live the questions. Makes us fall into comparing mind. Well, that person's got the answer. Or I got to fix this. Or, I always have to live the questions because I'm not capable of getting the answers. Whatever it is. Or got bad teachers and they don't help me get the answers. Whatever you may do in the ego mind, working around this, to live the questions. When we live the questions, we have a different kind of feeling with all of this. So, what am I addressing tonight? I'm addressing the difficult aspect of life, without giving you that there's many things that we usually in terms of dealing with difficult emotions. You get many teachings, and you've gotten many teachings from me. Those of you who are regular here around how the regular way of it's taught in this tradition to deal with that. But I'm really speaking at a kind of rawness tonight, which I think I wish I'd come next week or something. But I'm wanting by my aspiration was to let you feel rawness and to let rawness come in the room and see that you could be safe with wrongness. That you could be safe with a topic that seemed charged that you didn't quite necessarily understand what was being said. You can still be safe if you live the question through mindfulness, through compassionate mindfulness, with this intention of non-harming, of kindness, this intention of being able to choose non-suffering over suffering. We don't have to have the answers. We don't have to fix this moment. We don't have to fix ourselves right now. We don't have to fix this situation. It's unfortunate that the brother or the sister or the mother or the child or the coworker or the situation in a society or a culture or in the world is the way it is. But our sense of well-being is not contingent on that. We can stand the rawness of life as it is. We can stand it. We at times have to pick ourselves back up. At times we have to move our attention. This is right effort and eightfold path. We have to move our attention to nature because we can't stand to focus on human folly right now. That's skillful means. Skillful means to watch a movie that's a comedy at times. We're not running from life. We're titrating. We're dealing with what we can handle right now. So there's an easefulness of this. But we do not have to be afraid of the wrongness. But we take it into account with compassionate mindfulness, so we handle it for ourselves in the way that's right for us right now. Another student that lives in a country where there's a lot of kidnapping, and this student's a prosperous person. Every day this practitioner has to live, when this person's not on retreat, practically, because it's the only time they sort of leave that environment is to come on retreat because of all their duties. And every day they have to live with the fear. Every time they go out of their house, they might be snatched. Every day. Every day. So much wrongness of fear when first started practicing. And to watch someone find a kind of peace, a way to live with all of that, that's inspiring. And night and day difference in terms of the mental state when this person leaves the house now. Again, I'm being raw. This is rawness. This is rawness. But feel that it's okay. If this person has through their practice has found an okayness. It's not pleasant. It's not pleasant. Don't get confused with the sense that there's a sense of well-being. The well-being comes because this person knows why they're staying, knows the purpose, knows what they're doing. They can live with the trade-off of this unpleasantness. But it stays unpleasant in a major way. It would be that way to me. And so the circumstances of we can deal with unpleasant circumstances and still have some base sense of well-being, even though there's an anxiety that comes a lot and all. And you go, well, how do I do that right now? Because I'm afraid because of X or Y, of losing my job, because I was molested in some way, and every time I'm in this situation it comes up, or I was physically abused, and when I see somebody close a fist, I go into shock. Or it could be you're in a car wreck, and when a car turns rapidly in front of you, there's a kind of freeze that comes over you. All these kinds of things. How do you live with this? You live with it gradually and slowly, with this living the question, how do I be more skillful with this, using all the tools that the Dharma has taught you in all these ways? Sorry to be so intense about this, but I have a lot of feeling about this right now, and you happen to be in the presence of it. Anyone have something that they want to say or ask here? Yes.
I had a friend come up to me after the Dharma talk I gave last week, and she was feeling a lot of resentment that she had given up her life with her ex-husband, and she was carrying that resentment to the extreme of feeling lonely and depressed, and and regretting not being able to have children and stuff like that because of being in such a bad relationship. And I'm wondering how you would advise such a person.
Well, and that, so last week he was doing a teaching and he had someone come up who had made a decision that they really regretted. They really regretted that they thought was a life-changing decision that had taken much of their life away from them. And they were really being tormented by that in some way and sort of giving up on life in a certain way as you're reporting it. And so the question is, how do you respond to someone like that? First of all, there is no one level, two-sentence thing you can say that's going to help someone feel better than that around that situation. Acknowledging the difficulty of it is a first response that's appropriate. So acknowledging the difficulty. And then pointing in a direction, but not trying to help them, not trying to rationalize. So don't go under the pressure that you're supposed to fix this. It's a tough situation. It's a raw situation, like tonight. So if sometimes we can point someone towards a practice or towards something, sometimes all we can do is just be present and witness. And that witnessing is making a difference, for in that moment, someone didn't reject them because of their experience. They weren't found unworthy because of their experience or how they're feeling right now. I'm looking at the clock here, so I'm thinking we need to stop. And if we could just close our eyes for a moment. So letting go of the words. Opening to any felt sense that's true. Feeling what the belly, the intuitive body, is saying to you. What's been aroused in your intuition. Acknowledging it. Letting it go. Tuning into the heart space. An aspiration of the heart. A tenderness of the heart around a past or a present. Acknowledging what the heart would have you know. And then letting this too go. Turning to the head center. Any thoughts and feelings in the head center. That head center that is deductive and inductive in its process of knowing. That makes comments, makes plans. Anything that it wants you to know. And then letting it go and just be. Just 90 seconds, no thoughts, nothing, just be.